uses religion in a particularistic way to make them feel as if they belong by saying, your story is our story, and your God is our God.
The Tikva Fund presents Jewish Ideas and the American Founders. Jewish Ideas and the American Founders is dedicated by Alan K. Schwartz in memory of his wife, Barbara R. Schwartz, and in tribute to all Jewish Americans, both strangers and neighbors, and is supported by the Zahava and Moshe L. Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University.
Rabbi Soloveitchik, in this lecture, we're going to meet a wide array of figures from the Jewish community of America during the Washington administration. Who are some of these people?
We're going to meet again the leaders of Sheretz Israel in New York, only now we'll be speaking about those who have returned from Philadelphia to New York after the revolution, and to whom other Jews turn with a request to send Washington a letter following his inauguration, because of course the first capital of America is New York. So they are down the road from George Washington, so it seems logical that they should be the ones to send the letter. And of course, as we will see, they do not originally send him the letter. So we'll meet them. We'll meet some Jews who stayed in Philadelphia, including one, an amazing individual by the name of Manuel Josephson, who is a leader in Jewish Philadelphia and is also probably the most literate and knowledgeable Jew in America, because he has a great Jewish library. And so he also functions as a de facto posek. People ask him halachic questions. And he is the one who is going to lead the request to send a letter to George Washington. We'll meet Jews in Georgia who send their own letter to George Washington. And then, of course, we'll meet Moses Satius, who became famous as the man to whom George Washington responded when visiting Newport and sending him that immortal letter.
The various communities, Jewish communities in America, from Savannah to Newport and everyone in between, we know that they were optimistic about the new government. But what concerns did they have? What were their sentiments as they're looking out at the prospect of this new constitutional republic?
Well, we have to keep in mind that we need to see this new government not through our eyes, because we're sitting at a time when America, while still a young country, is also the longest continuous democracy on the face of the earth. For them, Jews and non-Jews, this is an experiment that has never been tried before. This is a form of government that has never been tried before. And now they have a national executive with immense power. And so they're no doubt delighted that it's Washington, because he's the hero of the nation. But if you're a Jew, or if you're a member of some other religious minority, if you're a Catholic, or if you're a Quaker, you're wondering, how am I going to figure into this new society that is being born? And you're certainly thinking, I need to do what I can to curry favor with the new leader of this country. If I want life in this country for my faith, for my community, to be one that will live up to all my hopes and dreams of what America could be. The inauguration of the President of the United States that took place earlier this year in many ways couldn't seem more different than the first presidential inauguration held nearly 228 years ago. America is now deeply divided, while George Washington was chosen by the Electoral College unanimously. Washington's first inauguration was held in April in New York. Today, his successors take the oath of office much earlier in the year in a much colder weather and in a very different location, in Washington, D.C., in front of the U.S. Capitol. But in truth, as I wrote in the Wall Street Journal, from which I'm quoting, every presidential inauguration is actually a recreation of Washington's. The first president's words and deeds that day helped set the stage for a civic ritual celebrating the democratic idea within a religious context, one which arguably cannot be found in another polity today. Now, there were aspects of the original ceremony in 1789 that we definitely do not do today and would seem more appropriate for a coronation rather than an elected leader's inauguration. Remember that an inauguration had never been held before, and things were different then. And so Washington arrives in Manhattan's Federal Hall in a magnificent carriage pulled by 6 white horses. He strode into the Senate chamber wearing white silk stockings and a ceremonial sword. He was then escorted to a balcony overlooking an ecstatic crowd, and many present were, quote, heard to say that they should now die contented, having seen the savior of the nation, according to one newspaper report. Washington was sworn in by New York Chancellor Robert Livingston, who administered the oath of office and then exclaimed, "Long live George Washington, President of the United States." But most noteworthy, I think, was the religious nature of the occasion. The Constitution, as we noted yesterday, makes no mention of the divine, and yet much of the trappings and oratory at Washington's inaugural were profoundly religious. Washington may not have actually added the words, "So help me God," at the end of the presidential oath, as it is often said, but it seems likely, according to the evidence, that he kissed with reverence the Bible on which he swore this very oath. And Washington's inaugural address emphasized the miraculous nature of the American Revolution. And he stressed that, quote, "No people can be bound to acknowledge and adore the invisible hand which conducts the affairs of men more than the people of the United States." And he added that some token of providential agency seemed to play a role in the country's independence. But the religiosity in use at Washington's inauguration is important not only because of how public it was, but also because of how inclusive it was and how it reflected America's denominational diversity. Washington's speech, written in collaboration with James Madison, refrained from doctrinal assertions. The inaugural procession featured 14 clergymen from New York, 13 Christians, and Gershom Mendes Sachs. This was the first time a Jewish religious figure had played a ceremonial role in the installation of a head of state since the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And Washington's inauguration celebrated thus the cohesiveness of the country while simultaneously emphasizing Americans' freedoms. His address suggested that the recent ratification of the Constitution, which peacefully unified Americans across the country without eliding their differences, was itself a miracle. As he put it, quote, "The tranquil deliberations and voluntary consent of so many distinct communities cannot be compared with the means by which most governments have been established without some return of pious gratitude." Now, to see how unique a ritual this actually is, let's take a foreigner's view of the inauguration, where Jonathan Sachs, who's British, has often marveled at how the religious nature of American civic culture compares with Europe. And he wrote that the United States is the only country today whose political discourse is framed by the idea of covenant. And the American inaugural, he suggested, is often a moment of American covenantal renewal, a rededication to the founding ideals. So Washington's first inauguration was one of the very few times that Americans were essentially united behind the new president. Since then, when we have a new administration, there are always millions of Americans who are unhappy with the electorate's decision. But Washington is showing that American inauguration, unlike a monarch's coronation, is less a celebration of the new head of state. It's actually a celebration of the United States, of its system of government, and it is meant to use religion in celebrating the divine blessings bestowed upon it, and utilizing religion to unite the diverse religious population of the country. It was Washington himself who made religion central to the inauguration, using religion to celebrate freedom, the Constitution, and the binding of diverse individuals together. The inauguration, then, actually tells us something about Washington and about the use of religion in his leadership. As the historian Michael Meyerson notes, the key to understanding Washington's view on religion and government is to appreciate that his continual quest as president was to use religion as a force for uniting the country. Just as he was concerned during the Revolutionary War with ensuring that religious differences did not raise, in his words, quote, the smallest uneasiness and jealousy among the troops, so too President Washington was determined not to permit religious differences to disrupt the new nation. As Michael Novak, writing with Jana Novak, had written, Washington's goal was to find a way of communicating that unites rather than divides a religiously pluralistic people. And this, as Michael Meyerson notes, can be seen in what immediately followed Washington's inauguration, when the diverse religious groups of the United States sent Washington letters, and Washington responded to each one, utilizing religion in his response to each one, but utilizing religion in a different way in each letter to make each religious group feel as if it truly belonged. So, as Meyerson writes, shortly after the inauguration, several Baptist clergymen wrote to the new president expressing their fear that the unamended Constitution permitted, quote, religious oppression should any one society in the Union preponderate over all the rest. There was no First Amendment, and that might not have stopped it anyway. Washington responded that he could never have supported ratification if he thought it could lead to religious tyranny. Quote, if I could have entertained the slightest apprehension that the Constitution framed in the convention, where I had the honor to preside, might possibly endanger the religious rights of any ecclesiastical society, certainly I would never have placed my signature to it. And then he wrote that if this actually occurred, he would, quote, establish effectual barriers against the horrors of spiritual tyranny, and added that every man conducting himself as a good citizen and being accountable to God alone for his religious opinions ought to be protected in worshiping the deity according to the dictates of his own conscience. That's Washington writing to the Baptists. Then we have the Catholics. A letter was written by John Carroll, a Roman Catholic priest, and representatives of the Roman Catholic clergy wrote to Washington to complain that they were still being discriminated against in particular states. And he wrote, as the price of our blood spilt under your eyes, Catholics have a well-founded title to claim from her justice the equal rights of citizenship. And Washington did not respond by saying, as he might have, look, we don't have power over the states, this is the national government, we don't discriminate, but the states are going to do what they're going to do. He responds by writing the following. As mankind become more liberal, they will be more apt to allow that all those who conduct themselves as worthy members of the community are equally entitled to the protection of civil government. And then he added the following. He said, the members of your society in America, animated alone by the pure spirit of Christianity and still conducting themselves as the faithful subjects of our free government, enjoy every, he's wishing upon them that they enjoy every temporal and spiritual felicity. So he's writing, someone who's definitely not a Catholic, writing to the Catholics and saying, even though you are rejected by Protestants as following an antichrist and as not being truly Christian, I see you as being animated by the true spirit of Christianity. And Washington, as Meyerson notes, understood that his letter would then be taken by the Catholics and printed and sent all over the country and even beyond the country, so that Catholics in England got a hold of Washington's response in England, where they were still being discriminated against, and said to England, look, these rebels that you fought against, they're more liberal and open-minded than you are. Catholics in England wrote the following. Is this not a lesson? Britons remain intolerant and inexorable to the claims of sound policy and of nature. Where is the boasted liberty which suffers not a disposal of ourselves, but aims so effectually to shackle and annihilate the soul from God? Britons view and blush. That is what the Catholics in England wrote, utilizing Washington's letter. Quakers wrote a letter to Washington as well, and Washington responded warmly to them in kind. So we have the Catholics following the inauguration writing one letter to Washington. The Catholics, right, they sent their letter. The Baptists get together, they send one letter to Washington. The Quakers get together and they send one letter to Washington. What about a group smaller than all of them in America? The Jews. The Jews send Washington three letters. Okay. It is these letters, the story of who sent them and the substance of Washington's responses to them, that we will focus on today. For as we will see, the saga of America's newly inaugurated president and its Jews actually teaches us a great deal, both about the cherished and happy home that Jews found in America, as well as the fragmentation, discord, and disunity that marked American Jewry in America from the days of the Revolution until today. Jews sent three letters. These are their stories.
Now, there's a long tradition in the experience of Jewish exile and Jewish diaspora of communities trying to curry favor with the leaders of the regimes in which those communities lived. Do you see this as something like that, or is this different in any way?
It's both like that and utterly unlike that. What I mean by that is as follows. On the one hand, yes, by reaching out to the new leader of this nation, they are following in the tradition of Jews who have lived elsewhere. At the same time, the Jews here are using their communications to Washington to remind him that under the terms of the Constitution, they are equals. And he, in turn, in different and extraordinary ways, as we'll see, differently to, say, Savannah than he will to Newport, responds by assuring them, absolutely, I see you as equals in this society. So whereas a duke or a king in Europe will write to Jews whom he knows are not his equals in this society, Washington is doing the exact reverse. And that's why his letters are so important, not just to the Jews who receive them, but they're so important to us today, because they are extraordinary documents of the history of the American idea. Immediately following Washington's inauguration, perhaps due to the lack of clarity of who truly represented American Jewry, or more likely because of disagreement among who truly did, no letter from the Jewish community was immediately sent to America's first president and its national hero, which is a shanda in its own right. By January of 1790, so we're talking 8 months after the inauguration, Congress had already moved America's capital from New York to Philadelphia, and the Parnas, or president of the Jewish community there, Mikveh Israel, a man by the name of Manuel Josephson, took it upon himself to get this coordination moving, to actually send a letter from the Jews of America to Washington. Now, Manuel Josephson was a remarkable and fascinating man. He was an Ashkenazi who had arrived in America in the 1750s. He lived in New York before the Revolution and, like Jonas Phillips, was one of the American Jewish patriots who fled the city when the British approached, served in the war, and then chose, like Phillips, to make his home in Philadelphia. And with Phillips, he helped create the synagogue in Philadelphia, Mikveh Israel, and served as its Parnas, or president, following Phillips' tenure as Parnas. Josephson stands out for two reasons before this story. First, like Jonas Phillips, Josephson was very dedicated to proper observance of Jewish law. We have from him today a remarkable petition to the synagogue, issuing a request for the construction of a mikveh, of a ritual bath. This is what Josephson writes to the community in Philadelphia. He writes, "It having pleased the Almighty God of Israel to appoint our lot in this country, the rulers whereof he has inspired with wisdom and a benevolent disposition toward us as a nation, whereby we enjoy every desirable privilege and great preeminence far beyond many of our brethren dispersed in different countries and governments. And in order to manifest our gratitude for those peculiar favor and blessings, we ought, in a very sincere manner, observe a strict and close adherence to those laws and commandments ordained by him and delivered to our master Moses of blessed memory, which have been handed down to us in a regular succession to the present time. In order thereto, we, the subscribers, having taken these matters to heart and duly reflected on the many defects this congregation called Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia labors under, and to our great regret and sorrow, we find one in particular, which strikes us most forcibly and cannot but affect with astonishment and horror every judicious and truly religious mind. This is the want of a proper mikveh or bathing place, according to our law and institutions, for the purification of married women at certain periods. Now, therefore, in full consideration of the foregoing, we have unanimously agreed that a proper mikveh for the sole use of our congregation be forthwith built. We do hereby, each of us for himself, most solemnly and religiously engage and promise to pay such sum of money as is annexed to our respective name without any hesitation. And we flatter ourselves that every married man will use the most persuasive and every other means to induce his wife to a strict compliance with that duty, so incumbent upon them, that so the Almighty may look down in mercy upon us and send the Redeemer to Zion in our days. Amen. So be it. End quote. This is most of the petition. Now, this petition from Josephson is interesting, not merely because of its zealousness and dedication to observance. Jewish history has been marked by many dedicated to the observance of Jewish law. Rather, Josephson's petition is fascinating because it is making the case that precisely because God has blessed America's Jews with freedom unknown anywhere else, therefore, he's saying, they, America's Jews, are particularly obligated, especially obligated, to use that freedom to adhere to Jewish law with love and loyalty in gratitude for God's gift that was America. So his remarkable statement is all the more interesting given the fact that over the centuries that follow, all too many Jews reacted to the freedoms afforded to them by abandoning their attachment to halakhic observance. But Josephson was interesting not only because of his own devotion to Jewish law, but also because of his role in guiding others regarding halakha. Truth is that even though there are spiritual leaders of Sheret Israel and of Mikveh Israel, they are not rabbis. No ordained rabbis arrive in America until a good way into the 19th century. Those who are leading these synagogues are called chazanim. They are hired to lead services and to preach and to give sermons. But they are not rabbis. And halakha questions are not necessarily coming to them. There are no rabbis in America. Really complex questions are sent to rabbis in England or in Amsterdam. Of course, by engaging in the revolution, Jews were actually in America cutting themselves off from the very source of halakha guidance. In the Annals of our Synagogue, there actually is a wonderful letter, this is before the revolution, from a very wealthy member of the New York Jewish community, who after the synagogue moved further north, I think this is maybe after the revolution, he wrote to England to ask whether it would be okay, since he now lives far away from shul, whether he could ride a horse and carriage, if it was driven by a non-Jew, to the synagogue. So he sends this letter to England. You can imagine it takes several weeks to get there, several weeks to get back. And instead of answering his question, the rabbi in England wrote, saying to him, "Are you a man of means?" So he said, he wrote back to the rabbi in England and said, "Yes, I am. I have to be honest. So he waits again a couple weeks, gets a letter back, and the rabbi wrote, "So move closer to the synagogue." Okay? Now, it's funny, but this shows the dedication of these individuals. They knew they did not know the answers they were seeking, and they knew they had to ask people to get the answers they were seeking. And even though they were living with relative freedom and could easily have done whatever they wanted, they were deeply interested in seeking religious instruction. So Josephson, as one of the most knowledgeable Jews in North America, as well as the owner of one of its most extensive halakhic libraries, emerged as a de facto posek, or religious decisor, for various American Jews. We can see this from a question sent to him from a man that we will meet again later in this lecture about Washington's correspondence, and that is Moses Satius, who was the brother of Gershom Mendes Satius and the lay leader of the Jewish community in Newport. Satius wrote to Manuel Josephson with two questions. He said, first, our shofar has cracks in it, and he wants to know if we can still use it for blowing on Rosh Hashanah. And to this, Josephson replies, yes, you can, but you can't plug it with foreign substances. You need to bind it so that the cracks are closed up. Josephson himself was a Baal Tekiah. He was someone who knew how to blow the shofar, and it was his shofar that was used in Mikveh Israel on Rosh Hashanah. And furthermore, Moses Satius wrote to him to say, we no longer have someone who could read from the Torah. Can they perform Kiryat HaTorah from a Chumash instead? And Josephson wrote back to him, much as a halakhic decisor would write, saying, no, and here's why. And he cites Shulchan Aruch, and he says explicitly there that you can't do it, etc., etc. So you have this man, not a rabbi, pretty wealthy, successful in business, and he is acting as a de facto posek. Religious zealot and halakhic decisor, not a rabbi. That is Manuel Josephson. And it was this fascinating individual who wrote from Philadelphia to New York, to Sheret Israel, New York, suggesting that he, Josephson, as the Parnas, the president of the Jewish community in America's new capital in Philadelphia, be the one to send words of greeting to the president. This, of course, was immediately refused by the leaders of Sherith Israel in New York. As the writer Yitzhak Levin puts it delicately, however, the Spanish and Portuguese Sephardic elite, who dominated the other congregations, objected to the Ashkenazic Josephson of humble Eastern European origins, considering him unworthy to speak for them, end quote. This is almost certainly true as a reason for why they refused Josephson as a representative, but there is more here to say. And that is, like many zealous individuals, Manuel Josephson was probably not the easiest person in the world to get along with. And while still in New York, before he moved to Philadelphia, had been involved in an unfortunate fracas between himself and one of New York's most distinguished Jewish families. As Howard Rock reports in his book, Haven of Liberty, New York Jews in the New World, Josephson actually described, made fun, or at least was accused of making fun, of a distinguished patriarch of the Simpson family, not that Simpson family, Simpson without the P, saying that he looked unkempt because of the way he had his tallit. This resulted in a terrible fight between him and that family, and that actually went to court with Josephson speaking out against other members of his community in that colonial court in New York. So this took place sometime before the revolution. Fast forward 19 years later, while the world has been, in the words of the famous song, turned upside down and a new country has been born, old grievances remain. And it is not surprising that Sherith Israel did not want this Ashkenazi upstart representing them to the President of the United States. Thus, in June of 1790, recall that this is over a year since Washington's inauguration, Sherith Israel in New York sent out a letter to other Jewish communities of America saying that, quote, "We are desirous of addressing the President of the United States in one general address, comprehending all the congregations professing our holy religion in America, as we are led to understand that this mode will be less irksome to the President than troubling him to reply to every individual address." So he says, they're saying, we want to represent you. Send us what you'd like us to put in to this letter. And we, the most important Jewish community and its oldest in America, New York's Jewish community, we will send the letter to Washington. And the leaders of Sherith Israel received several replies, but unfortunately, not the ones they were hoping for. Moses Satius wrote from Newport, Rhode Island, to say that given that Rhode Island's Jews were very small, and given the fact that even the legislature of Rhode Island did not yet congratulate formally President Washington on his inauguration, it would be improper for Newport's Jews to participate in writing a letter to Washington. However, Satius then added, to stick the knife in, that while it would be inappropriate for us to actually write a letter to Washington, you guys should feel terrible for having dilly-dallied up till this point. And he wrote as follows, quote, "It was incumbent on you from your local situation, and as being the eldest congregation within the United States of America, to have formed that system and transmitted it to the other congregations when no doubt they would have cheerfully coincided therein, but for you to procrastinate a measure which was eagerly embraced by all public bodies for a year without taking the least notice thereof, it might and would readily be supposed that you did not mean to pay any attention thereto, or if you did, it was to be done on contracted principles." This is the classic response. He says, wouldn't be right for us to address Washington, but you guys should have done it a long time ago, and you have brought shame upon us all. This was the response that New York Jewry received from Newport. From Savannah, Georgia, they received what must have been an even more distressing reply. The Georgian Jews essentially said, "We sent our own letter already a month ago, in May of 1790. Now, New York Jewry was incredibly annoyed at that, writing to the other communities that, in our view, we have been very badly treated by the Georgians, end quote. Now, you might criticize Georgia Jewry here for acting on its own, were it not for the fact that it was already a year after Washington's inauguration, and he had received letters from every other American faith community, really, except for the Jewish community. And so Savannah, in May, a month before Sherith Israel's letter goes out to all the Jewish communities, sent out, to the dismay and discovery of New York's Jews, a letter to Washington on its own. And though the letter that Washington would write to Newport is more famous today, it is this letter, the Savannah letter, that I believe to be the most extraordinary. And now, knowing the background, we can better appreciate what the Jewish leadership of Savannah writes to Washington, and knowing the role, as we've described, that religion played in the American inauguration, we can better appreciate Washington's response. Let us begin by reading several sections of the letter written by Levi Shaftal, who with his brother Mordechai was a lay leader of Jewish Georgians. Here is how they write their letter. They begin, "Sir, we have long been anxious of congratulating you on your appointment by unanimous approbation to the presidential dignity of this country, and of testifying our unbounded confidence in your integrity and unblemished virtue. Yet, however exalted the station you now fill, it is still not equal to the merit of your heroic services through an arduous and dangerous conflict, which has embosomed you to the hearts of her citizens." And then they write, "Our eccentric situation, added to a diffidence founded on the most profound respect, has thus long prevented our address." As they're saying, you may have been wondering why you haven't heard from the Jews in America for a year. It's because we respect you too much, and we were a little afraid to write you. Of course, they're not going to write the truth, which is that we were fighting with each other, and we never got around to sending you a letter. Yet, they write, "the delay has realized anticipation, giving us an opportunity of presenting our grateful acknowledgments for the benedictions of heaven through the energy of federal influence and the equity of your administration. Your unexampled liberality and extensive philanthropy have dispelled that cloud of bigotry and superstition, which has long as a veil shaded religion, unriveted the fetters of enthusiasm, enfranchised us with all the privileges and immunities of free citizens, and initiated us into the grand mass of legislative mechanism. By example, you have taught us to endure the ravages of war with manly fortitude, and to enjoy the blessings of peace with reverence to the deity, and benignity and love to our fellow creatures." So the letter goes on. So what are the Shaftals doing here? Ostensibly, they're merely writing to congratulate Washington on his inauguration. But in their carefully chosen words, we can discern something else. Remember, we take the stability of American government for granted today. But at the time, no one knew what would result from this extraordinary experiment. America is a young country today, but now it is the oldest continuous democracy in the history of the world. But at the moment, nobody had tried anything like this. And religious minorities were particularly concerned as to how they would fare at the hands of this leader, who had just been greeted in New York like a king, and who had more power than the King of England. How is he going to treat us? And so they take pains in their congratulations to say, "It's too bad that we wrote you so late, but the good news is that over this past year, we've been able to see the extraordinary equality that you have reflected toward everyone, and that we too are welcomed in the legislature, and that the Constitution grants us full equality." And as they're writing to him to remind him, beseechingly, that we too need to be treated as equals in this new country. How does Washington respond? In his answer, all Washington needed to do was thank them politely. He could have gone further and said, "Absolutely, I'll treat you equally, don't worry." But Washington does much more than that. Let us see a bit from his extraordinary response. He responds in June of 1790, precisely when Sherith Israel is getting its act together to try to draw the various communities of America to write to Washington. Washington is already writing a response to the Jews of Georgia. And he writes, "Gentlemen, I thank you with great sincerity for your congratulations on my appointment to the office, which I have the honor to hold by the unanimous choice of my fellow citizens." Then he goes on to say, "I rejoice that a spirit of liberality and philanthropy is much more prevalent than it formerly was among the enlightened nations of the earth, and that your brethren will benefit thereby in proportion as it shall become still more extensive." Meaning he's saying, absolutely, I agree with equality. Our national government has this. He recognizes that they don't have equality in all the states. They're not welcomed into all state legislatures. But he's saying, I hope that that will change as well. And he knows when he's writing this that the Jews are now going to use this letter to lobby for full equality at the state level. And he continues, "Happily, the people of the United States have in many instances exhibited examples worthy of imitation, the salutary influence of which will doubtless extend much farther if gratefully enjoying those blessings of peace which under favor of heaven have been obtained by fortitude in war, they shall conduct themselves with reverence to the deity and charity toward their fellow creatures." And now Washington writes, a paragraph in concluding his correspondence that is perhaps the most remarkable paragraph written in the history of American Jewry. And he writes, "May the same wonder-working deity who long since delivering the Hebrews from their Egyptian oppressors planted them in the Promised Land, whose providential agency has lately been conspicuous in establishing these United States as an independent nation, still continue to water them with the dews of heaven," meaning the Jews, "and to make the inhabitants of every denomination participate in the temporal and spiritual blessings of that people whose God is," and then he gives the pronunciation, J-E-H-O-V-A-H, which Jews do not pronounce, "George Washington." What is he saying in this paragraph? He's saying several things, all of them absolutely incredible. He's saying, first of all, the story of the God who saved you from Egypt and brought you to the Promised Land, your story is parallel to our story. Mi she'asa nisim la'avoteichem, the God who did miracles for you, u'mimitzrayim ga'alchem, and took you out of Egypt, to paraphrase the Jewish prayer, that is the God who has created a Promised Land for us. That's the first thing he's saying. The second thing he's saying is that this God that saved you in the past and blessed America now, he is blessing you now as well. Meaning, in contrast to the Christian story that is being told in Europe, that there is a God who once chose the Jews but has since rejected them, Washington is saying explicitly that he is still blessing you and that your experience in America is part of that blessing. And third, he is saying that when we, all the other denominations, receive the blessings of that God, all other religious denominations, we are participating in the temporal and spiritual blessings of this people, of the people of Israel. All in one paragraph. All Washington needed to do was to say thank you. What we might expect him to do was to write what he wrote in the next paragraph, which is, of course, I believe in equality, and I want your equality to be permanent here. But he goes way beyond that. He uses religion in a particularistic way to make them feel as if they belong, by saying, your story is our story, and your God is our God. That's what Washington does here. He's doing much more than responding to a letter. He is seeking to do what he did in his response to the various Christian denominations, to make them feel as if they belong, but he's going beyond that by saying, the God who performed miracles for you, it is he who performed miracles for us. Your story is our story. That's the letter he wrote to Georgia and to its Jews, a letter that is virtually unknown today. Meanwhile, this is June. So in June, George Washington writes a response to Savannah. In June, Sherith Israel writes to all the diverse Jewish communities of America, asking them to join in their communication. Newport immediately writes back saying, we can't join you. Then in August of 1790, the President of the United States pays a visit to Newport, Rhode Island. And now Moses Satius, lay leader of that Jewish community, realizes that he had better send something to Washington. So now he writes his own letter and sends that to Washington, to which Washington immediately responds. Now one can only imagine the reaction of New York's Jews when they hear this. The very Jews that had refused to join them and the ones who insulted them right back to their face and said, it would not be right for us to engage in communication, but you guys are terrible. Now, they jump the gun, and they write to Washington before New York does. And this letter to Newport and Washington's response is the most famous communication between Washington and the American Jewish community. But this one, as well, is not correctly appreciated. For the letter that Washington writes is most famous for a phrase that Washington did not himself compose, but merely was referencing the letter that was written to him by the Jews of Newport. The most important sentence in Washington's letter to Newport is, in fact, a different one that Washington didn't himself think up. And this sentence is extraordinary and worthy of study. Let us understand this by reading first what Moses Satius wrote to Washington, and then by reading Washington's response. So here is Moses Satius's letter. Quote, This is 17 August 1790. Permit the children of the stock of Abraham to approach you with the most cordial affection and esteem for your person and merits, and to join with our fellow citizens in welcoming you to Newport. And this, they say, is the first time that Washington actually visited a synagogue. So this was, if he truly did visit the synagogue in Newport, this was the first time that a synagogue was ever visited by a president of the United States of America. And if Washington sat through a sermon at the synagogue, then in Newport they could put up a sign over Washington's seat that says, George Washington slept here. Okay. Here is what Moses Satius writes. With pleasure we reflect on those days of difficulty and danger, when the God of Israel, who delivered David from the peril of the sword, shielded your head in the day of battle. So now, this is Moses Satius making the move on his own that Washington himself made in writing back to Savannah. He's saying, the God who saved David, he's the God who saved you. And we rejoice to think that the same spirit who rested in the bosom of the greatly beloved Daniel, enabling him to preside over the provinces, he writes not Babylonian, but Babylonish empire, rests and ever will rest upon you, enabling you to discharge the arduous duties of chief magistrate in these states. Deprived, then they get to the same concerns that Savannah has, which is equality. Deprived, as we have heretofore been, of the invaluable rights of free citizens, we now, with a deep sense of gratitude to the almighty disposer of all events, behold a government erected by the majesty of the people, a government which to bigotry gives no sanction, to persecution no assistance, but generously affording to all liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship, deeming every one of whatever nation, tongue, or language equal parts of the great governmental machine. We cannot, he adds, but acknowledge this to be the work of the great God who ruleth in the armies of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, doing whatever seemeth him good. That is Moses Satius' letter to Washington. Washington immediately responds. This letter was dated 17 August. Washington's response is dated 18 August, 1790. And he writes, gentlemen, while I receive with much satisfaction your address, replete with expressions of affection and esteem, I rejoice in the opportunity of assuring you that I shall always retain a grateful remembrance of the cordial welcome I experienced in my visit to Newport from all classes of citizens. And then he gets to the subject they mentioned, which is equality. The citizens of the United States of America have a right to applaud themselves for having given to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy, a policy worthy of imitation. All possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. And then he writes as follows. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of, as if it was by the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving it on all occasions their effectual support. So the most famous phrase in Washington's response is his description of the government of the United States as a government which gives to bigotry no sanction and to persecution no assistance. That's a phrase you see everywhere. But the truth is, Washington did not come up with that phrase. That he was merely echoing exactly what Moses Satius wrote to him. And that's how you do it politely. He says, you're right. You called this a government that gives bigotry no sanction, persecution no assistance. And that's exactly what this government is. It gives bigotry no sanction and persecution no assistance. But what Washington adds is a political point that he does on his own. And that's the sentence that comes before this reference to bigotry no sanction and persecution no assistance. And that is the sentence where he writes, it is now no more that toleration is spoken of, as if it was by the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. So Washington is building on the entire history here of political thought and religious liberty in writing this one sentence. Many knew that one of the classics of religious liberty was Locke's letter concerning toleration, which was, at the time, a great breakthrough for religious freedom, where Locke made the case that we can't control anyone's mind, and therefore we shouldn't persecute anybody, except Catholics and atheists, he writes. But anyone else should have toleration. But Washington understands that that's not what Jews here are seeking. And so he's saying to them, this is not England. England, you are tolerated. What that means is no one's persecuting you. You can worship, you don't have to, in your synagogues, you don't have to worry about pogroms. But that's not here. The watchword of America is not religious toleration, which was the word that was used to signify open-mindedness. Washington is saying, we're going much further than that. We are talking about equality. You are not here because we are allowing you to be here. You are here because you deserve to be here just as much as us. This is the sentence that Washington adds. And so we have two very different letters to two different Jewish communities. One references largely the biblical miracles, whereas Washington, even though he could have in his response, because Sayce just mentioned biblical miracles, in his response to Newport, makes no reference to the biblical miracles. The letter to Newport makes no mention of the miracles referenced in the Savannah communications, but we are now able to see, actually, that the two work together in tandem. One is about, in part, theology, and one is about politics. One says, your God is our God, the God who did the Exodus, did the American Revolution. We are only enjoying the blessings of God because we are partaking in the blessings that he bestowed on the chosen nation. And the other says, you are here as equals, not because of religious toleration. The two, as classics of the American idea, must be read and taken in tandem, though they are so often not read in that manner, because the Savannah letter is unread and unappreciated. But actually, we're able to see that the Newport letter is building on the Savannah letter. One complements the other. The assurance to Newport of true equality, and not merely toleration, is built on the sentiments expressed in the Savannah correspondence. Because after all, if the Jewish story is so central to the American imagination, and if the story of Israel's God is so important to the way Americans see themselves, how can the Jews be merely tolerated in America? How can they be treated as anything but equals? Washington has thus sent two letters to America's Jews, both important, both treasures of American letters. Different, one theological, the other political. The letter to Georgia identifies biblical Israel with America. The letter with Newport ensures their extraordinary equality in America. There were now four Jewish communities that had yet to write Washington, including its most important one. There is New York, Philadelphia, Charleston, and Richmond. In November of 1790, so a year and a quarter following Washington's inauguration, Charleston wrote to New York Jewry anxiously asking, what in the world is going on? We sent you a draft of what we'd like to go. Why hasn't this letter been sent? Meanwhile, at this point, Manuel Josephson and his synagogue take matters into their own hands. In the words of one history of the Philadelphia Jewish community, he, quote, alerted New York's leadership that Philadelphia, not hearing any further news, told Isaac Moses in New York that they had prepared an address and were going to present it to the president on the occasion of the removal of the capital from New York to Philadelphia. That, at last, crystallized the affair. I'm quoting. The Parnas president of Sherith Israel sent Josephson drafts he had received from Charleston and Richmond. Because now they realize, if we don't act, this guy is going to talk to the president without even mentioning us. And now Philadelphia will speak to the president of the United States and won't even give any credit to New York's Jews. So the Parnas president of Sherith Israel sent Josephson drafts he had received from Charleston and Richmond and agreed that the Philadelphian should go ahead with his plans. And on December 13th, Manuel Josephson wrote to the Hebrew congregations in the city of Philadelphia, New York, Charleston, and Richmond to tell them that he had gone to represent them personally to President Washington and had the honor to present their letter to him in person. Meaning he actually met with Washington, you know, knocked on the door, said, Shalom Aleichem, I have this letter, and was favored with his answer. And then Josephson, and this is my favorite part, Josephson was writing to the officials of the New York congregation. He assured them that, quote, he had made it a point to inform the president verbally the reasons of your congregation's seeming remissness in not having paid the respects before. And he seemed perfectly satisfied. I love that because, on the one hand, that seems to mean, I made excuses for you, he's fine, don't worry. But it could also mean, you'll never know what I told him about you and why we have delayed in actually sending this letter to him. Now, this letter had largely been prepared by Josephson, who signed it on behalf of all four congregations. Josephson wrote to Washington the following, quote, We have been hitherto prevented by various circumstances peculiar to our situation from adding our congratulations to those which the rest of America have offered on your elevation to the chair of the federal government. Deign them, illustrious sir, to accept this, our homage. The wonders which the Lord of hosts hath worked in the days of our forefathers have taught us to observe the greatness of his wisdom and his might throughout the events of the late glorious revolution. And while we humble ourselves at his footstool in thanksgiving and praise for the blessing of his deliverance, we acknowledge you, the leader of the American armies, as his chosen and beloved servant. So it sounds very similar to what the other Jews had written to him before. But at this point, Washington, having received this letter, must have been thinking, what is wrong with these Michiganers? And why do they keep sending me letters? And why do I have to respond to every single one of them? And so this response, in contrast to the two other extraordinary letters, appears perfunctory by comparison. And he immediately responds, Philadelphia, 13 December, 1790. And he writes, "Gentlemen, the liberality of sentiment toward each other, which marks every political and religious denomination of men in this country, stands unparalleled in the history of nations. The affections of such people is a treasure beyond the reach of calculation, and the repeated proofs which my fellow citizens have given of their attachment to me and approbations of my doings form the purest source of my temporal felicity." And then he adds, "The power and goodness of the Almighty were strongly manifested in the events of our late glorious revolution, and his kind interposition in our behalf has been no less visible in the establishment of our present equal government. In war he directed the sword, and in peace he has ruled in our councils." And he adds, "May the same temporal and eternal blessings which you implore for me rest upon your congregation." So it doesn't have the extraordinary religious message of Savannah, and it doesn't have the extraordinary political message of Newport. It's more perfunctory. Washington saying, "Oh, enough already. Fine, I'll write another letter to these crazy Jews who keep sending me letters for some reason. I thought I was done, but I'm going to write another letter." That is the saga of the three letters that the Jews of America sent to George Washington. And in a certain sense, these three letters that Washington sends in response tell us a great deal. The first letter of Washington to the Jews of Savannah tells us a great deal of the founders' biblically based affinity for and affection for Jews in America. The second letter to the Jews of Newport tells us a great deal about the political freedom that Jews found in America. And the third tells us a great deal about the total disunity of Jews in America. Thus, from the story of Washington's letters, we can learn several lessons, some inspiring, others less so. First lesson is that with absolute freedom can also come total fragmentation. This tale sets the stage for the future of American Jewry. American Jewry will never have a chief rabbi, and they will not have a lay leadership that can come close to representing even a plurality of their community. They will have nothing like the United Synagogue in England and its chief rabbinate, or France's chief rabbinate. This actually goes hand in hand with the equality and the freedom that they have. In part, the chief rabbinates that emerge in Europe comes about because Jews feel that they are not truly equals, and therefore they need leaders that will represent them in the courts of cabinets and kings. As Rabbi Sacks himself, a chief rabbi, puts it, "Jews in England for many years had a wonderful life, but it was," he compared it, "to being a guest in someone else's remarkable home. It's like being a guest in Downton Abbey. It's wonderful, it's tremendous opportunities to enjoy yourself, but it's not truly yours." Jews in America were told by Washington that this was truly their land as much as it was anyone else's. You are fully equal and you are fully free. And with that equality and that freedom is wonderful. And with that lack of central authority can come vibrancy and creativity. But also what emerges is utter lack of unity. It is this vibrancy, this creativity, and this utter lack of unity that have characterized American Jewry from Washington's age till today and contrasted it both in vibrancy and in disunity from any other diaspora Jewish community. That's the first lesson. Second lesson is that it is often as difficult as people as Manuel Josephson might have been, or the leaders of Sheretz Israel, and as much as that difficult nature may have come to the fore in the fragmentation and in the events leading up to these letters. The truth is that it is often difficult people like Josephson or the leaders of New York Jewry who can come to a land where there is no centralized leadership and where they have freedom and equality and still hold on tenaciously to Jewish observance. We mentioned that Jonas Phillips is buried in New York, not Philadelphia, because at the end of his life he was in a terrible disagreement with the synagogue that he had helped found. This, alas, was true of Manuel Josephson as well. And we have in the records of the Philadelphia Jewish community that Manuel Josephson himself, following his fallout with Mikveh Israel, was asked to share his shofar with the community for Rosh Hashanah. And he said no, because he was so angry at them. This is a Jewish story. And yet, at the same time, it is often difficult people in American Jewry's earliest moments that have the tenacity and the stubbornness to actually cleave to Jewish law. It was Rabbi Sacks who used to cite from a teacher of his a fascinating interpretation of a seemingly difficult verse in the Torah. After God informs Moses, following the worshiping of the golden calf, that he will destroy Israel, ki am kashe oref hu, because they are a stiff-necked people, Moses replies, no, God, yelech na Hashem bekirbenu, ki am kashe oref hu. Forgive us and dwell among us, because we are a stiff-necked people. This is a strange thing to say. Moses should have said, dwell among us despite the fact, or even though we are a stiff-necked people. But that is not what he says. And it is Rabbi Sacks' teacher who interpreted this homiletically. Moses was saying to God, you're absolutely right. Jews are a stiff-necked people. And they're often getting into fights. And they're often letting you down. And they have stubbornness and stiff-neckedness. But there will come a time in history when that aspect of themselves will make itself manifest in a positive way. When that stubbornness will come to the fore. When that tenacity will make itself manifest. That is true about some of the difficult individuals that helped found the Jewish communities in America. They weren't easy to get along with, but it was those people, unlike many other Jews, who clung tightly in America to Jewish observance and saw it as their obligation to utilize the freedoms afforded to them by America to embrace even more fully a life of Torah observance. That's the next lesson. Third, the story of Washington's letters, both to the Jews and to other religious groups, highlights that Washington is not only the hero of the American Revolution. Washington ought to be remembered as a father of religious liberty in America. As Michael Meyerson notes, as president, Washington accomplished what many people today would consider an impossible task. On the one hand, he was a leader, greatly underappreciated in modern times, in the battle for freedom of religion in America. At the same time, he was able to speak in devout religious language without destroying the unity he was committed to creating. This success was due in part to what has been termed his amazing ability to speak the devotional language of even rival religions. To Presbyterians, he spoke like a God-fearing Protestant. To Methodists, he implied his support for revivals and religions. To Jews, he invoked the Old Testament. And to American Catholics, he wrote that they were animated alone by a pure spirit of Christianity. Jefferson will get a lot of credit for helping to enshrine in law religious liberty in America. But it is Washington who should first and foremost get the credit for making Jews feel as if they truly, truly belonged in America. And finally, the lesson that we should learn is to appreciate the letter of Washington that few ever quote and rarely study. And that is the letter that Washington wrote to the Jews of Savannah. This letter is a Jewish and American treasure because Washington does more than just use religion to make them feel as if they belong, like he does with Catholics or Baptists. What Washington does here is actually create a parallel between the Israelite story and the American story and speaks of the Jewish relationship with God in a way that no Christian in Europe would publicly speak at that particular time. This is not in the Newport letter, it is in the Savannah letter. And yet it is much less famous, few know of it. And an ironic reflection of this may be the fact that while the original of Washington's communication to Newport and his original communication to the Jews of Philadelphia is extant, the original letter to Savannah has been lost. We do not have it today. Thus, an article in the Jewish newspaper, The Forward, reports as follows. Just a little more than a year after George Washington became America's first president, Levi Sheftal, a Jew from Savannah, wrote him a letter. Sheftal, president of Congregation Mikveh Israel in Savannah, congratulated Washington, but as if to prove that even in its infancy, American Jewry was rife with jealousy and infighting, this seemingly innocuous letter caused an uproar. Because why was Savannah first, Jews and other communities wanted to know. Congregations in New York, Philadelphia, Charleston, and Richmond soon remedied the matter. The rest is history. Washington's famous reply to the Jews of Newport continues to resonate today. But, he says, the Savannah letter, it seems, has been lost. The letter has been missing for so long that many of Savannah's Jews don't even know that it is gone. During a recent visit to the city, American Jewish historian Jonathan Sarna said a docent in the Temple Museum assured him the letter was in the congregation's archive, even though it's not there. And it's a reminder, he said, that we don't often seem to know where these great documents are. Forward further reports that in a tour of the synagogue today, you can go visit that synagogue in Savannah. It does not say they show a replication of the letter, but it does not say that the original is missing. And quotes Bobby Levy, a docent, who was asked what she tells visitors if they asked about the whereabouts of the original Washington letter. And she replies, "We fudge as best we can," end quote. Which reflects the fact that we often do not even understand the treasures and the heritage that is the letters of American Jewry. At the same time, even without the original, the words of George Washington's letter to Savannah speak to us today. Words joining biblical Israel story with America's story. And that letter reflects and defines the American Jewish experience throughout the centuries and allow us further insight into a speech that was delivered many, many years later by a successor to Washington, centuries after his passing. And that is the speech given by President George W. Bush in the Knesset, marking the 60th anniversary of Israeli independence. Here, too, the president could have just given a warm congratulations. He could have said some nice sentiments. But he does much more than that. And he goes out of his way to imitate Washington in joining the story of Israel, both biblical and modern, with the American story. And to utilize that parallel that Washington first established to explain both the story of Jews in America and also of America's support for the state of Israel. And he says words that no other American president have said since the founding of the state of Israel. He says, "The alliance between our governments is unbreakable." That's not the thing. Every administration says that.
"The alliance between our governments is unbreakable. Yet the source of our friendship runs deeper than any treaty. It is grounded in the shared spirit of our people, the bonds of the book, the ties of the soul. When William Bradford stepped off the Mayflower in 1620, he quoted the words of Jeremiah, 'Come, let us declare in Zion the word of God.' The founders of my country saw a new promised land and bestowed upon their towns names like Bethlehem and New Canaan. And in time, many Americans became passionate advocates for a Jewish state. I've been fortunate to see the character of Israel up close. I've touched the Western Wall. I've seen the sun reflected in the Sea of Galilee. I have prayed at Yad Vashem. And earlier today, I visited Masada, an inspiring monument to courage and sacrifice. At this historic site, Israeli soldiers swear an oath. Masada shall never fall again. Citizens of Israel, Masada shall never fall again, and America will be at your side. 60 years ago, on the eve of Israel's independence, the last British soldiers departing Jerusalem stopped at a building in the Jewish quarter of the old city. An officer knocked on the door and met a senior rabbi. The officer presented him with a short iron bar, the key to the Zion Gate, and said it was the first time in 18 centuries that a key to the gates of Jerusalem had belonged to a Jew. His hands trembling, the rabbi offered a prayer of thanksgiving to God, who had granted us life and permitted us to reach this day. Then he turned to the officer and uttered the words Jews had awaited for so long. I accept this key in the name of my people. Over the past six decades, the Jewish people have established a state that would make that humble rabbi proud. You've raised a modern society in the promised land, a light unto the nations that preserves the legacy of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And you have built a mighty democracy that will endure forever and can always count on the United States of America to be at your side. God bless.
The speech is actually, as Elliot Abrams once said to me, one of the great speeches in the history of Zionism. But it is also one of the great speeches in the history of America, because we have a president doing something extraordinary. You have a president saying to representatives of the Jewish people, our story is your story. We support you because in a certain way you are us. Your story is ours and your democratic values are ours. We identify with you religiously, biblically, and we identify with you politically. It is extraordinary. But the truth is, the story of Bush's speech does not begin with his speechwriters composing it in the White House. The story of Bush's speech does not begin with Bush's election. The story of Bush's speech begins in a different address that was written by his predecessor centuries ago. Because not many presidents of the United States would have said exactly what Bush did, but the greatest president of the United States actually did do that, and thereby defined America's relationship with its Jewish citizens, and thereby created an effect that would ultimately help define America's relationship with the state of Israel as well. It was many centuries before Bush that a president of the United States did the same exact thing, wrote to Jews who were worried about their existential safety, and said to them, you can count on America, because our story is your story. And so it seems, therefore, appropriate to conclude, given the fact that now Americans live assured of their equality in America, whereas the Jews in Israel, to whom Bush spoke, still have to be concerned every day about their existential safety. It seems appropriate to conclude with the words that Washington wrote to Newport and its Jews and apply it thereby to Jews elsewhere in the world, in the Promised Land. I conclude with these words, and even though Washington wrote it about American Jews, something tells me that George Washington would not have objected to this application. May the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. Jews in Israel are still hoping for that and are still waiting for that. And knowing the blessings that Washington bestowed upon Jews in America, we extend to Jews all over the world the blessings with which he concluded in his letter. May the Father of all mercies scatter light and not darkness in our path, and make us all in our several vocations useful here, and in his own due time and way, everlastingly happy. Amen. Kei nihi ratzon. Thank you very much.
Rabbi Soloveitchik, in this lecture, you showed us a variety of letters that President Washington received and a variety of responses that he was moved to write. What did these different responses show us about Washington and how he thought about religion in the United States?
These letters are absolutely incredible. And each letter is interesting in its own right, but they're also very different, as I discussed, from one another. Now, the third letter is perfunctory. I mean, it's a wonderful piece of history which is cherished by the community in Philadelphia to this day, and rightly so. But at this point, you can imagine George Washington saying, oh, I have to write another letter to the Jewish community. Why can't they get their act together? Just send me one letter. But of the two first letters, Savannah and Newport, they're very different. And each in their own way is showing the Jews that they are equals. One is saying to the Jews a religious message. And here Washington is using a method that he applied also in writing to Catholics and to Quakers and to others, speaking in a religious language that is geared toward what they want to hear. But with the Jews, he's saying something even more extraordinary, because this is something that no Gentile leader has ever said directly to a Jewish community. He's saying, the God of the Bible is our God, and in a certain sense he's saying, your miraculous story is parallel to our miraculous story. Now, imagine receiving a letter like that from the head of a new nation when you're nervous about what your place will be in this country. That's incredible. The second and most famous letter, the one to Newport, is not, there are biblical references, sit under his vine and fig tree, and no one shall make him afraid, etc. But there the message is political. It's repeating Moses Satius' line, bigotry no sanction, persecution no assistance. But the extraordinary phrase that Washington adds is that it is no longer toleration that is spoken. You're not here because we're tolerating you here. We are making the jump from Locke's letter concerning toleration, which was itself a great advance in the history of Western freedom, to equality. You are full equals. And you're full equals not merely as Americans, the way Frenchmen maybe after the Revolution are equal as Frenchmen. You are equals as Jews, because you're both Americans, but you're still the children of the stock of Abraham. And we recognize both aspects about you.
And how do you see the different reactions to the letters on the part of the Jewish community as foreshadowing some essence of Jewish behavior and Jewish life in America in the many generations that follow?
We don't know how precisely each Jewish community reacted when they received the letter. But the entire saga is both wonderful and sad. And in that respect, it foreshadows the Jewish experience in America, which in its own way is both wonderful and sad. Because the story highlights the extraordinary acceptance and embrace that Jews experience in America, but also the total fragmentation of the Jewish community in America. That fragmentation can at times be a source of Jewish vibrancy, but also a source of Jewish weakness. And all that is happening in this America with not that many Jews, and still couldn't get their act together to send one letter when Catholics could do that and other religious communities could do that. So the wonderful aspects and the somewhat pathetic or sad aspects, all of these are not surprising given what we know about the history of Judaism in America and of Jews in America that is to follow.
To what extent do you think that President Washington's letters and this whole story that you've told us sheds light on the way that the traditional and unique way that Americans have thought about religion in the public square?
This is very important. And one of the points that I'll make in a few of our lectures is that to Jefferson and to his acolyte Madison goes the credit for really working to enshrine religious freedom in law. So it was Jefferson who is most proud of, among all of his achievements, one of the three of which he's most proud is the author of the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom. So Jefferson and Madison really should be recorded as founding fathers of religious liberty in America. But a third, as some historians point out, but not enough, is Washington. And what Washington does is different. Washington does not enshrine into law religious liberty. What Washington does is, to various groups that are really potentially on the outskirts of society, Jews, Catholics, he is speaking to each one of them and using language they want to hear by saying, you belong here. But he's not using secular language to express that, he's using religious language. And that is obviously very different than any reception that Jews received in Europe. No reception that Jews received in Europe was ever as warm, and certainly never as religious as this.
Next on Jewish Ideas and the American Founders, Adams, Jefferson, and the Jews.